And welcome to the Naked Zoo News Review. I'm Jared Dreyfuss.
And I'm Adam Dreyfuss.
We are a news and sports program, but today we have a special edition of the Naked Zoo News Review. We have the whole show will be devoted to an interview. In our last show, we had a story about the conflict between the theory of evolution and the theory of intelligent design. And that's a place where religion and intellect are supposed to conflict. We may have Adam with us now.
Yes, sir.
Adam?
Yeah, you don't have my volume up.
Oh, I haven't picked him up.
Hello?
Oh, we'll have to keep trying this. Today, in this interview, we're going to explore another. It is thought by many that belief in God in the God of the Bible and in his Son is strictly a matter of faith, and that faith alone can support such a belief. The idea that an intellectual case for these beliefs is seldom considered. We have as our guest today, if the other half of our phone equipment is operating, Dr. Gary Habermas, Distinguished Professor of Apologetics and Philosophy and Chair of the Department of Philosophy and Theology at Liberty University in Virginia. He received a Master of Arts in Philosophical Theology from the University of Detroit, a Doctor of Divinity in Theology from Emmanuel College, Oxford, and a Doctor of Philosophy in History and Philosophy from Michigan State University. Let's try Adam one more time. Are you there?
Dr. Habermas and Dr. Dreyfuss.
Well, I haven't brought Dr. Habermas up. I'm hoping he's there. I'm just getting finished with his credentials. He is the author of a recent book that we had as a pledge premium on the show during our recent pledge drive called The Case for the Resurrection of Jesus. Let's bring up line one and see what we can. Dr. Habermas.
I am here, fellows.
Oh, excellent. Trouble with Adam, but none with you. Sir, did you
hear Adam?
Pardon?
I can hear Adam.
Oh, you could?
Yes, I can.
Okay, well then we're all hearing each other, and isn't it fine?
That's good.
So you were hearing things. Did I do justice to your credentials?
That sounds fine to me.
Okay. I'd like to begin with two things. I'd like to begin by thanking you, Doctor, for taking time to be with us. And I would like to also thank you personally and publicly for the role you played in my own coming to faith. I came across your work included in the works of Lee Strobel.
Oh, yes.
And was very impressed, and it was certainly a part of my path, and I appreciate it very much.
Well, thank you. That is, there's just nothing like hearing something like that. I appreciate you telling me.
Well, thank you. I would like, with your permission, I would like to begin this discussion by having you describe what this new book that you've done with your co-author on the resurrection is not.
Okay. Well, Mike Lacona, co-author, and I, we don't object to the typical approach, which says something like, hey, look at the Bible, it's a pretty good source. When we measure it up against ancient manuscript evidence and how close, say, the New Testament was written to Jesus, and compare archaeology and extra-biblical non-Christian sources, the New Testament looks pretty good. And if it's a trustworthy book, then, and of course, you're off and running with your message. You know, we think that approach works okay, and you can do it, but we think a much stronger approach is what I call the minimal facts argument. And basically what this does is it only discusses data that have two features in common. One is, basically what I say is I will not use any facts, at least the major facts that we put on the table. I won't use any data that are not multiply attested from a number of different angles, secondly, the large majority, I mean, that's an understatement, but virtually all critical scholars who study this same material will allow these same facts. I would say the 4, 5, 6, 7 facts that I would put on the table are probably agreed to by 95 to 99% of everybody who writes today, and it doesn't make it really makes virtually no difference whether they're atheists or liberals or moderates or evangelical Christians. They grant this data. And so we kind of put these facts on the table and say, so what do you guys make of this? And that's the approach we take, that, you know, I think the Bible's the word of God, but that's not what we're doing. I'll say it this way. Look, if it's the word of God, Jesus has been raised from the dead. If it's not the word of God, in the sense of it being an ancient book of history, or worse, simply an ancient book of literature, any of those views, bottom line is Jesus was still raised from the dead. So what are you going to do with the resurrection? And, of course, the resurrection is the heart of the gospel. So if this method works, we're at something very, very central, very, very important.
And you say your ability or your willingness to say that this is accepted by this wide-ranging spectrum of scholars is the result, I take it, of considerable care and research.
Yeah, frequently when I'm at state universities or I am somewhere like where I am in a week where I have to respond to one of the top critical theologians of the world, and it's not a debate, but it's a dialogue, and they'll be real friendly and so on. When you're in those guys' presence, you can't make the claim that everybody grants these facts if the guy sitting across the table from you says, hey, well, I don't, you know. And the guy who I'm dialoguing with, myself and another guy, it's the three-way dialogue in Philadelphia in about a week, actually a week from tomorrow, he's published some huge volumes. He's very influential. He's got a 1,000-page book on what we can know about Jesus. And he has a list of facts that's very similar to mine. In fact, quite a few scholars do this sort of thing. They'll say, well, I don't accept these facts, but I'll accept these. And it's the second group that we put on the table. But to answer your question more directly, when people get a little nasty sometimes, and they'll say to me, say a state university, I'll say, well, how do you know 95? I'd have to take your word for this. And I'll say, well, you can count yourself if you want, but the reason I know 95 to 99% of critics acknowledge this stuff is because I counted. And I've specialized in the resurrection for 35 years, and lately, being convinced that my bibliography was not up to date enough, I went back and tried to at least get a reference to, and in most relevant cases go through, more than 2,000 sources on the resurrection between 1975 and the present, and these were written in French, German, and English. I kept a running tally of where all these guys were on about 100 sub-issues. So when someone says to me, how do you know this? I'll say, because I counted, you know, but you're free to go count if you want to, if you don't agree with my point. So, you know, but of the two criteria, when I say 95-99% of scholars agree, so why argue? Why argue about the data? Let's argue about what the data mean. When I say that, that still is not quite as important as why so many scholars agree. They obviously wouldn't concede these things. Critics would not concede these things unless these things are well-grounded. So the first point of saying they're well-grounded, they're multiply attested, that's by far the more important point.
This I wanted to get well-established the credibility that you have for making the statement that these facts that we'll be discussing are so well accepted across the... So, once again, just it's radio, and we want to make sure everybody understands. Atheists, skeptics, evangelical Christians, historians, scholars across the board who have studied these issues in this material, 95% of them will accept these minimal facts that you and Mr. Lacona built this book on.
Right. And you say 95% of them. 95% of the ones who study this area and who publish on it. If they're in a university position somewhere and they don't publish on it, I don't know what they hold. But I can only judge from what they write. And, yeah, if I can count their writings, yeah, I'm prepared to say this is rarely not granted. By the way, for more skeptical listeners, I mean, you know, how can you be further to the left than, say, some of the guys in the study who are atheistic New Testament scholars? I mean, how much further do you want to move? But let's say somebody there says, well, yeah, but, you know, here's what I don't have in common with your atheistic New Testament scholars. If they accept fact X, I don't. I don't accept that one. So let's say, you know, if I'm only putting 4 to 7 facts on the table, if that's all I'm putting there, there's always room and time for a guy who's interested to say, hey, I don't accept any of your facts. And if he, and I'm, I mean,
there was a reader's review of your book on Amazon.com, and that's precisely what he did.
Yeah, well, he's free to do that. Now, first thing I'd say is this guy, I mean, if he has a PhD in the area and he's well-published, he will be extremely, extremely rare. But that's his right to hold that. I still would not say to that guy, well, I guess we can't talk. What I would do is start from the bottom up. I would start at zero. And how long is it going to take you to discuss 5 to 7 things? I mean, we're not discussing 100 facts. We're just discussing a half dozen. And I would lay the data out there for each one of them, and I would ask him to tell me what's wrong with my reasoning.
Well, let's start with one.
Yeah.
Let's start with the fact that you start with in the book. And as I told you off the air, I'm a believer, and so none of this stuff surprises me anymore. But it astonished me when I came to belief that I was believing it.
Right.
I take it from what we've said, accepted across the board, that in fact there was such a person as Jesus of Nazareth, and in fact he was killed by crucifixion.
Yes. Well, you're going to look a long way to find people not concede that. If you said to me, okay, in your count, how many scholars do not think Jesus lived in history? Well, I'll give you names, but there's two people in my study of more than 2,000 sources. One of them, I think, recently, I was told by a mutual friend that the one guy just recently passed away, G.A. Wells. He's a retired British. He's a professor, but he's not in this area. He's a professor of German, but at Birkbeck College, University of London. He publishes in this area, but that's not his area of study. Still, he doesn't say Jesus never lived. He just says, I'm not sure there's good enough data to believe that. And then a second guy who builds on his work is a philosopher named Michael Martin. He's retired, but the two of them lean that way. But they will still grant my data, or virtually all of it, because what I talk about is the Apostle Paul. I use Paul's case, unlike a lot of other guys. If you're going to put your best evidential foot forward, you use Paul instead of the Gospels. A lot of the critics will grant pieces of the Gospels, but they will grant virtually all of Paul.
Now, what gives Paul this enhanced authenticity and credibility?
Yeah, he is sort of the critical darling today. Now, that doesn't mean they love everything he says. They just say that what he says comes with authority. The reason is because they think of the 13 books of the New Testament that bear his name. They will grant, unanimously, they will grant 6, 7, 8 of those books as being written by Paul. Take the fellow I just mentioned, G.A. Wells, the fellow who may have passed away, the German scholar.
Uh-huh.
He's written some really super, super critical stuff about Jesus, and yet he will grant 8 of Paul's 13 epistles. Now, 8's pretty good.
It's not bad.
Yeah, especially when you hear that what they grant is always the books that Christians want to use. There is no discussion about Romans, 1st and 2nd Corinthians, Galatians, Philippians, 1st Thessalonians, and Philemon. And when you're, you know, studying theology or trying to make a case about the early church, it's always 1st and 2nd Corinthians, Romans, and Galatians, and Philippians that you want to use. And they'll give it to you. And they'll say, okay,
Paul wrote those books.
A, Paul wrote them. B, he was a scholar. He was a Jewish scholar who you might call him a scholar athlete, because in a way, you know, he studies under Gamaliel. He's a Jewish Old Testament scholar, and then he's got to be in a good enough physical shape to traipse across the countryside. Of course, he's on his way to Damascus when all this happens. He uses sports illustrations throughout his epistles, usually boxing and track and field. So I take it the guy, you know, likes this kind of stuff, but when he's pulling Christians out of homes and imprisoning them and killing them, he's not going to be some little wimp where you can just jerk your hand out of his arm and say, get out of here. You know, he's probably a pretty good specimen, physical specimen. So the guys look at him and they'll say, A, we know what books he's written. B, he's a scholar. And C, he was an eyewitness. And you say, well, of what? Well, we don't know that he knew Jesus before Good Friday. Everybody, including G.A. Wells and Michael Martin, these two guys way, way over on the left,
yeah,
both of them will concede the following sentence. Paul had an experience which he believed was an appearance of the risen Jesus. They concede that. They will also concede that James, the brother of Jesus, a former skeptic, he had an appearance, which he believed was an appearance of the risen Jesus. They'll believe it. They'll grant that the disciples thought they had these kind of experiences. So, boom, now you can start talking, because these guys were disciples of Jesus. They were running around, hung out with him, knew what he was about, and they think he was raised from the dead. So it's they're the ones that we investigate.
So now we are in. We've accepted the documents. We've accepted the understanding or belief of the authors or the people described in the documents of what they understood had happened, and we're starting there. I'm just going to take a short sidestep here, because this is so reminiscent to me of how I began the path, and that was reading for the first time as a full adult the Old Testament, and then being told by a Jewish friend of mine the manner in which the Jews have kept the purity of that text over the millennia, and wondering why at the beginning these people would have devoted these resources to this arduous, exacting, punitive method of keeping that text copied accurately and purely, and coming out sort of thinking, I can't think of a reason for these people to do that except the one they describe in the work itself, that they had this experience of the direct intervention of God in their lives. And a direction from that God they experienced to keep this recorded, and they did so. And we're kind of on the same ground now. We have this description of the activities and the actions and beliefs of people, these first century scholars and athletes and apostles who understood that they had seen the risen Jesus, and now we're explaining their conduct and trying to find, from the skeptic's point of view, trying to find some other way of explaining their conduct other than what they said it was.
Well, yeah, that's exactly what you have to do.
Adam, you in there?
Yeah, I am. I think it would be also, I've read your book. I am not a believer in the sense of that my father is. You know, I believe in something out there, but I definitely do not fall in the Jesus was resurrected camp.
Sure.
I thought it was interesting that the approach that you took with the minimal facts, and the way that you address that, it's easy to get sort of off base. I mean, I think the three of us probably combined have had plenty of these. I'm definitely not a resurrection scholar by any stretch of the imagination, but many of these conversations with people, and they go all over the map.
Right, right.
And you can get caught up in abortion and gay rights. You know, next thing you know, you're very far afield. And I think it was a nice approach that you took, saying, hey, let's just sort of keep our eye on the ball. One of the things I wanted to ask you before we got too deep into the minimal facts approach is from a sort of a layperson's point of view, and even someone who, you know, read your book in great detail, enjoyed it, played the CD, which I found very amusing. I thought I didn't think that the little guy on the CD was going to be quite as much of a smart mouth as I was like, wow, he's got pretty rough.
There was a computer firm that did that CD for us that comes along with the book, and a professional actor. Mike, actually, my co-author, actually got that, and it was rather amazing because that thing cost. It was like $250,000 to make that CD, and they donated it. But they had this professional actor back there, and they thought, all right, if we get a little bit saucy here and a little bit cute and a little bit of a comedian, well, you know, it'll be a reason for people to persevere with this stuff. So that's actually you're right. That's the angle for which they did it. And hopefully it was a little bit fun as you went through the questions.
Now I feel very shut out because I couldn't play the CD because I have a Macintosh computer.
Uh-oh. Okay.
I'm sure
so now I'll be waiting for the second edition with the Mac-friendly version of the CD aboard.
I should tell. You're the first people folks to mention that. I should tell our publisher because I don't know how much it would.
I have no idea either.
To convert it.
One of the questions I wanted to ask you is as regards to sort of the groundwork that you laid in putting this book together, is that it seems that to enter the conversation, you sort of discount the internal disagreements between the Gospels. You sort of say, okay, yeah, they kind of disagree with each other, you know, in a fact here and a fact there, but we're not going to kind of look at that. As a skeptic's sort of point of view, that seems an awfully big concession to make right out of the gate.
Okay. Yeah, great question. It's for two reasons that we do that, and I think I mean, when I'm doing this with the guys on the other side who specialize in this, they really don't even push it. And the reason they don't, let me give you my two reasons. We don't make a big deal of the so-called discrepancies in the Gospels because, first of all, our method is such that it says, okay, Adam, you and I are going to talk about this, and let's put on the table facts that we agree to. And you say, well, listen, I'll tell you what I don't agree to. These five appear contradictory to me. And I'll say, okay, keep in mind what our method is. Our method is to talk about what we can agree on. Let's talk next week about the five we don't agree on. But one reason you don't talk about the discrepancy places is because that's not something we agree on. And the minimal facts method says I have these things in common with the people I talk to. So that's one reason. Now, I could see a critic saying, hey, yeah, but wait a minute. What if there's enough of these other ones that make me question their overall testimony? And I'll say, well, if there are, then we need to look at it. But my second contention, besides the fact that we'll just talk about what we have in common, is the ones that remain. My contention is the ones we agree on will be the kind that if we agree to those, the contradictory or potentially contradictory or apparent discrepancies will not offset those. To use an example, let's say we have a car accident out in front of your house and the police are taking reports from four or five eyewitnesses. The eyewitnesses disagree about any number of things, and we take it's because one of them's a friend of the guy in one of the cars. Other people are from other angles. One person admittedly was not watching the entire process. So we say, all right, fine. But nobody disputes that there's a car accident. Nobody disputes that there's a guy driving a red car, a woman driving a green car, and, you know, and the general layout is like this, and here's where the cars got hit. Eventually, the police officer or a court may need to make a judgment about who was to blame, but there's no disputing the accident. I would say that's a similar analogy, that you could be kind of picking around the edges with the resurrection, but none of the potential discrepancies, none of the ones that the critics discuss, have the ability, even if true, they do not have the ability to offset the major facts. So that's my second reason. It really does digress. Now, if you said later, well, look, I did what you asked me to, and we spent all last Saturday afternoon talking about your five, six, seven facts. Now I really would like to do something I'd like to do and talk about these three discrepancies. I'd say, hey, I'd love to do that with you. That's fine. And if you want to bring up one of the discrepancies right now, that's fine. I don't mind. I don't think it's so far afield that we shouldn't do that. But I'm just saying if we're going to stay on task, my contention is that none of the problem areas will offset the areas we're sure about.
Okay, I understand that. I think it would be good to move forward. I had one because I have a biblical scholar on the phone, and this happens to me so infrequently.
Yeah.
My dad beating each other up. that the Bible is essentially written in Greek, and Jesus spoke in Aramaic, and we read it in English. How do I, my faith level in that what I'm reading in English is pretty much exactly, because it comes down to, I mean, I am the Son of God, the resurrection, I mean, it's clear that this is very important that they're saying, okay, yeah, he was risen. Just translation-wise across, you know, three fairly disparate languages, that what I'm getting when I'm reading my, you know, my English Bible is essentially the same text that was, you know, or the same information that was conveyed in that first century.
Do you want me to answer that?
I hope so.
Oh, okay. I thought you were asking your dad.
Oh, he never listens to me, doctor.
Oh, okay. Well, Adam, I will start with an assertion. Now, the assertion is not the same as a fact, but the assertion will tell you where I'm going.
Okay.
If you did this in front of, say, Anthony Flew, this atheist buddy of mine who's the best known philosophical atheist in the world until he became a theist or a deist recently, Tony and some of these critical scholars I'm talking about, they'd sit there and they'd say, Adam, I don't mind if you ask that question, but that really is a little bit far afield, and here's the reason. Virtually all critics will concede that the text we have in the New Testament, because that's the Greek text you're talking about, the text
right.
we have is what the authors meant us to write. Nobody disputes that. The easiest way to tell that is to pick up a, quote, liberal New Testament translation or not evangelical translation, put it side by side with a, quote, evangelical translation and try to find some significant differences. I mean, they don't agree. The liberal church doesn't agree with the evangelical church on what we should agree today, but they both agree on what Paul said. Now, you say, well, okay, but what about my three language question? All right, let's use an analogy. There are two well-known biographers in the ancient world of Alexander the Great. The better-known one is Plutarch, a Roman. Interestingly enough, Alexander speaks Greek because he's Macedonian. Plutarch, you know what? I should check this out before I say it. But Plutarch's either writing in Greek or Latin, being Roman. I do not know if he's writing in Latin or Greek, but let's just say for the sake of the argument, he's writing about Alexander in Latin. And us today, I can't read Latin. And so I'm going to have to be satisfied to read an English translation of Plutarch telling me about Alexander. This doesn't slow down anybody. And if that's not a good example, I mean, if we find out Plutarch wrote in Greek, I would just use an example where somebody writes about a major guy, and he writes in his own language, and I read the translation in Greek. I would just change the analogy. And I would not question, neither would the ancient historian question, that we can know. And now, in this case, this is even better. Plutarch's writing about what Alexander said. Let's say Alexander wrote something, which he didn't. But if all Plutarch is doing is translating Alexander, the best thing you would do would be to get the Greek text, put it on the table. Let's say you're a scholar in Greek and Latin. Put the Greek text on the table. Put the Latin text on the table. Put the American text on the table so you can read all of them. If for some reason the Latin doesn't match the Greek, you know, within a fair translation, you know, range. And if the English doesn't match the Latin, one of the biggest critiques of this book is going to be, that's not what it says. So all you would do, somebody who could read all three languages would just check it out.
Perfect.